Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 84, The Anatomy of a Lobotomist. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
I found out that he was the man as far as lobotomy goes, that a lot of the rise of lobotomy and a lot about its decline could be directly attributed to Walter Freeman and his personality and the approach that he took to the operation. And that's what made me interested in writing a biography of him. He was this very perplexing figure. I could not understand quite a bit about him. Brilliant, undeniably brilliant, highly respected. He was not a nut working at the fringe of medicine. And yet he advocated this procedure that today most of us are disgusted by and might even consider criminal.
That was the voice of my guest, Jack L. High. Jack L. High is author of the 2005 book, The Lobotomist, the story of Dr. Walter Freeman, a maverick medical genius and his tragic quest to rid the world of mental illness. Jack L. High is the president of the American Society of Journalists and Authors, a winner of the June Roth Memorial Award for Medical Journalism, and the recipient of both the British Medical Journalists Association's annual Open Book Award for 2006 and a Minnesota Book Award. American Experience, the PBS documentary series, is currently producing a program based on the book. Medical schools and other institutions all over the country have invited L. High to speak about Freeman's life and legacy. The New England Journal of Medicine has credited the book with lighting a resurgence of interest in the history of lobotomy and the life of Walter Freeman. A contributor to the Atlantic Monthly, the Washington Post Magazine, American Heritage, and numerous other publications, Jack L. High lives in Minneapolis. Here's the interview. Jack L. High, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Great. Well, before we get into your book, tell us how you came to be a writer in the first place.
Well, that's a long story. I have been interested in writing ever since I was a child, mostly writing short stories. And in fact, the first pieces that I ever had published were works of short fiction in literary magazines. But I got into writing nonfiction and journalism soon after I graduated from college, when a friend of mine got a low-level editorial position at a city magazine here in Minneapolis where I live.
Uh-huh.
And I was once talking with her about some unusual books I had seen in the stacks at the public library, and she said, "Wow, that's weird. Why don't you write a short piece for us about that?" Which I did, and went on from there. Since then, I've written probably 400 or 500 magazine articles.
Wow!
And then I've done 7 or 8 nonfiction books.
Wow! My hat's off to you. As somebody who was an aspiring writer myself, I majored in creative writing as an undergraduate. So my hat is really off to you for. All the successful writing that you've done. We're going to be talking about your book, in which you've written a biography of a lobotomist, or the lobotomist. But just to make sure our listeners are on the same page, describe what a lobotomy is.
A lobotomy was a surgical operation, a form of brain surgery, that was used to treat the symptoms of various kinds of mental illnesses, illnesses ranging from what we would today call chronic depression and schizophrenia to bipolar disorder, and then some other illnesses or disorders that were problems at the time in the mid-20th century, such as what was commonly called shell shock from returning servicemen, sexual behaviors that were considered disordered, and criminal behaviors that were then considered possibly treatable by lobotomy. So what happened in a lobotomy was that some of the neural pathways connecting the thalamus in the brain with the frontal lobes were severed. In most lobotomies, parts of the brain were not cut out, as some people believe. There were just severed neural pathways, and the idea behind lobotomy was that it was a theory in currency in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s that a lot of the symptoms of mental illnesses resulted from overly urgent emotional signals originating in the thalamus and reaching the frontal lobes. And by cutting the pathways, the doctors who advocated lobotomy hoped to blunt the strength of those symptoms. And so that's why lobotomies happened.
Okay, and maybe we'll talk about those details again as we get further into it. But first, how did you become interested in Dr. Walter Friedman, Freeman, who developed the lobotomy procedure?
I first became interested in him about 11 years ago when I met a woman whose uncle had had a lobotomy in the Minnesota State Hospital system. And his case was interesting to me, partly because his lobotomy had happened quite late in the game. He had his lobotomy in 1968, and it surprised me that lobotomies were still happening in state hospital systems as late as that. And I later found out that they were happening quite a bit later than 1968.
Wow, but that surprises me too.
Yeah, I, from talking with this woman and hearing her describe her uncle's experiences, I got the idea to write a magazine article about lobotomy patients and how lobotomy was performed in the upper Midwest. So I went to a lot of the magazines that I had been writing for a lot at that time, and everyone rejected it. They thought the topic was too gross, too unappetizing. And I finally found a medical journal that was willing to publish my story. And so I researched that story and wrote it. And in the course of doing that research, that's how I found out about Walter Freeman, because I interviewed a retired neurosurgeon who had watched Freeman demonstrate lobotomy at Hastings State Hospital in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. And even though that lobotomy had taken place more than 40 years earlier, this neurosurgeon had a very vivid and very unpleasant memory of what he had witnessed. So that encouraged me to dig more into Freeman's life, and I found out that he was the man as far as lobotomy goes, that a lot of the rise of lobotomy and a lot about its decline could be directly attributed to Walter Freeman and his personality and the approach that he took to the operation. And that's what made me interested in writing a biography of him. He was this very perplexing figure. I could not understand quite a bit about him. Brilliant, undeniably brilliant, highly respected. He was not a nut working at the fringe of medicine. And yet he advocated this procedure that today most of us are disgusted by and might even consider criminal. So I wanted to resolve in my own mind that discrepancy, and that's what got me into writing the book.
Yeah, in your speaking of the sort of repugnance with which your initial proposals to magazines was greeted, in your prologue, you start out by noting that Freeman ranks up there with the Nazi doctor Joseph Mengele as one of the most scorned physicians of the 20th century.
Yes.
Lobotomy has such a strong stigma associated with it now. Did this create any obstacles for your work once you got into the book?
I think the main obstacle was within myself. I went into it with such a negative impression of the operation, and the idea from reading books like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and seeing movies like Frances about the actress Frances Farmer who purportedly had a lobotomy, that it was hard for me to comprehend that that this may not be a completely black and white kind of story, that there was, in fact, a context that lobotomy happened within. And so a lot of the discovery for me in writing The Lobotomist was in finding out that context and in understanding why Freeman was attracted to lobotomy, why he stayed with it so long, past the point of reason. And those were, you know, there were professional reasons for that, and there were also some very personal reasons for mm-hmm. that.
And do I recall correctly that you found a diary that he wrote about himself quite a bit, and that gave you good source material?
Well, one of the lucky things about writing about Walter Freeman is that he is a biographer's dream, in the sense that he wrote an enormous amount of material about himself and about his work. So I was quickly onto a large archive of his personal and professional papers at George Washington University in Washington, D.C., where he taught for a quarter century. And in that archive, there was a manuscript of an unpublished autobiography, which was, of course, very useful to me in my research.
Oh, yeah.
There were also many letters that he wrote to patients, you know, correspondence back and forth between him and patients and his colleagues. And there were also Walter Freeman's lobotomy case study files. He had a file on each one of the 3,400 people he had performed a lobotomy on. And George Washington University considered those files medical records and would not let a researcher like me, a non-medical researcher like me, look at them. So I was left with the other material. Fortunately for me, within the other material, there was a great deal of information about patients, and that had not gotten into the other files. And so I used that extensively in my research. I also had the help of Walter Freeman's three living sons, who are all in their 70s now. Mm. And one of them provided me with a scrapbook that Walter Freeman kept during those glory years of lobotomy, the late 40s and early 50s. And the scrapbook contained newspaper clippings, but also carbon copies of letters, telegrams that he had sent and received, and a lot of other personal information. That was just a gold mine.
Yeah, you really hit pay dirt. When you struck out to do the book, I guess you weren't even aware of the existence of all these collateral materials that were so helpful.
No, and in fact, I thought that in that early stage that most of my research would be involved in interviewing people, especially patients. I'd hoped that there would be a lot of lobotomy patients still out there for me to talk to, and that turned out not to be the case. I did interview several, but most lobotomies, you know, occurred quite a while ago. You know, the peak years were the late 1940s and early 50s, and most of those operations were done on people who were middle-aged at that time.
Yes.
So not very many patients are still alive, and those who are tend to be those who had lobotomies as children or as adolescents, and often they can't remember too much about what was going on then.
Yes. Well, Jack, take us through the story as best you can. I know it's a lengthy book, but we've got some time, and if you just kind of take us through the highlights of his personality, his education, whatever you want to touch on.
Okay. Happy to. Well, the book begins with a chapter that gives an account of the very first lobotomy performed in the United States, and that was in 1936 at George Washington University's hospital. And the patient was a woman in her 60s named Alice Hammett, who had suffered for a long time from what I'm sure we would today call chronic depression. And her depression had gotten worse after the birth of a couple of children. And she also had developed some obsessive behaviors, an obsessive interest in her hair. And she was quite debilitated. And there was an instance in 1935, I believe, where she and her husband went on a driving tour of the East Coast, got lost. And that sparked a real breakdown in Mrs. Hammett. And so she and her husband went to consult with Walter Freeman to see what could be done about it. As it turned out, for the 5 or 6 months before the Hammetts arrived in his office, Walter Freeman had been corresponding with a Portuguese neurologist named Egas Moniz. And Dr. Moniz, during 1935, had done a series of 20, not lobotomies, but what he called leucotomies. This was a slightly different operation, but still involving severing neural pathways in the brain to treat psychiatric problems. And he had written medical journal reports on the experiences of those 20 patients. Freeman was really enthralled by that and began a correspondence with Dr. Moniz. And Freeman became determined to be the person to introduce this type of operation to the United States, which he did with Alice Hammett in September 1936. And as it turned out, everyone considered her operation a great success. She was hospitalized for about 3 weeks. She was at first quite disoriented, but gradually regained the use of her faculties, but did not feel her symptoms as acutely. Her depressed feelings and her obsessive behaviors. She was still aware of them. But they bothered her less, she said. Mm-hmm. So she went home, and she lived another 5 years until she died from pneumonia. And her husband later wrote to Freeman that those 5 years were the happiest days of their married life.
Interesting.
And so Freeman and his surgical partner, James Watts, who was a neurosurgeon, began their own series of 20 patients in 1936. It ended at the very end of that year. And the results were not uniformly as successful as Mrs. Hammett's experience. There were a couple of patients who suffered some quite severe after effects of lobotomy, and one or two who died also directly as a result of the operation. But they reported their results to medical societies and were encouraged enough to continue. And at this stage, you know, I think it's important to remember that Freeman and his colleague Watts were not trying to cure anybody of anything. They were trying to reduce the severity of symptoms, and they were trying to get people out of hospitals. At that time, and over the next 10 years, there was a terrible crisis in psychiatric hospitals all around the country. It was a two-pronged crisis. One part of it had to do with the lack of effective treatments. This was a time when there were very few, if any, effective pharmaceuticals to treat people with mental illnesses, and even some of the less appetizing therapies that we know about now, like insulin coma therapy and electroshock therapy, they were just getting started in the late 1930s. So there was a lack of treatment, and then there was terrible overcrowding in many hospitals and horrendous living conditions. Mm-hmm. These hospital wards were filthy. People were warehoused in mental hospitals often for decades on end because there were no treatments to help them get better. So Freeman was responding to what he perceived and what many other people perceived to be a great crisis in psychiatry. And so over the next 10 years, he and Watts performed about 700 lobotomies. And these lobotomies were, you know, looked like any other kind of brain operation. They were done in operating rooms with anesthesiologists and sterile draping and all that. But in 1945, Freeman began to grow impatient with this kind of lobotomy, which they called prefrontal lobotomy. And he wanted a procedure, kind of a portable lobotomy procedure, that could be moved out of the operating room and into psychiatric hospitals. Because even though these places were called hospitals, after all, they didn't have operating rooms, of course. They didn't have neurosurgeons and anesthesiologists. What they did have were plenty of sick people, and also ECT machines, electroconvulsive therapy machines. They had those aplenty by then. And so Freeman devised a new kind of lobotomy, which he called transorbital lobotomy, that took a different approach to reaching those neural pathways in the brain through a natural opening, the eye orbit of the skull. Mm. And at the very top of the, and I apologize to your listeners if this might get a little gruesome. I have had people faint in book readings as I've described this. And I hope no one out there will faint. But at the very top of the eye orbit in the skull, there's a thin bony plate that's very easily broken or breached. And so Freeman pioneered a pathway by using a device, a tool called a leucotome, to place the point of that instrument on that bony plate and then using a hammer to just hammer through. And once he was through that bone, then he was right where he wanted to be at the frontal lobes and could make the cuts that he wanted.
And they could do that without damaging the eye in the process.
The eye was not damaged. The eye itself was not damaged. Mm-hmm. Patients often emerged from this with a lot of swelling and irritation, black eyes, but the eye itself was not damaged at all. Mm-hmm. And as you can imagine, this kind of operation was done blind. Freeman could not see what he was cutting, and he relied on his knowledge, and he did have extensive knowledge of brain anatomy and landmarks in the skull in order to do these operations. But it was inexact. And
and
I believe that almost everybody who had a lobotomy had a different operation.
Yeah.
Because different neural pathways were cut and slightly different regions of the brain were affected.
Yeah, because they didn't have the imaging tools that we have today. If one were going to do that same procedure today, they'd be able to see exactly where they were going, right?
That's right. And the only imaging tools available then were, after the fact, x-rays. So they could see what they had done, but they couldn't see it while they were doing it. So Freeman not only, what made him so important in the history of lobotomy was not just that he developed this procedure, but it was that he championed it for years and went all around the country to psychiatric hospitals in 25 or 30 states, demonstrating transorbital lobotomy and training other doctors to do it. The doctors he was training were not surgeons. He was not a surgeon. He was a neurologist by training. But he believed that this kind of lobotomy could be done as an outpatient procedure. And I should add that even though there was no general anesthesia during this kind of lobotomy, the patients were unconscious because they had been treated beforehand with the electroshock machine and rendered briefly unconscious.
Oh, my goodness. A double whammy.
Yeah, a double whammy, right. And so Freeman performed an additional 2,800 or so lobotomies during his career by this transorbital method. The first was in 1946, and when I wrote my book, the first patient who received that kind of lobotomy was still alive. And then the last lobotomy that Freeman performed was in 1967, and that was done in California at Herrick Memorial Hospital in Berkeley. That operation didn't go well, and as a result, Freeman lost his operating privileges in that hospital, and it was the last hospital in which he had those privileges. So that was effectively the end of his career. And so just to kind of wrap up this book description, the lobotomist traces that Freeman's involvement in that history of lobotomy, but also it's a biography, and it goes quite a bit into his personal life. And I was very interested in finding out what aspects of his personal life played into his conduct as a neurologist and lobotomy advocate. And I found that there was a lot, that they had quite a bit to do with one another, that Freeman was driven professionally in part because of troubles in his personal life.
Mm-hmm.
He witnessed the death of his 11-year-old son very tragically and horrifically at Yosemite National Park, and he had a troubled marriage and a lot of other problems. So that, in a nutshell, is what the book covers. You asked initially, David, about his early history, and Freeman was born in Philadelphia, and he came from a very prominent medical family. His grandfather had been president of the American Medical Association and was the first brain surgeon in the United States. And I think it was from that grandfather that Freeman got his drive to achieve and to make his name, make a name for himself and to be seen as an innovator.
Yes, and you go into kind of the backstory of him as a child. I got the impression he was kind of an odd child in some ways, not socially, not very social, not athletic.
Yeah, he was a loner, which in some ways may have benefited his career, but I think in the long run hurt a lot because he made, I think because of his loner tendencies, he made a decision in 1954 to leave his faculty position at George Washington University and go out on his own as a sole practitioner. And as a faculty member at a university, I think his colleagues had kept him in check quite a bit, especially Watts, his partner in lobotomy. But once he was out on his own, there was no one to keep him in check, and he became much more radical in his ideas about who should have lobotomies. He came to believe that lobotomy should not be seen as an operation of last resort, but instead as a much earlier intervention, even before people became hospitalized, that they, in the early stages of diseases like schizophrenia, they should receive a lobotomy, and it might prevent, Freeman believed, the disease from getting worse.
My goodness. I was struck by how many well-known names in the history of psychiatry weave in and out of your account. When you're giving the backstory, you touch upon Broca, who worked on mapping the brain, Benjamin Rush, who is the father of American psychiatry and the founder of a psychiatric ward at the University of Pennsylvania Hospital, even Charcot, the famous French neurologist with whom Freud studied. Can you tell how these people came into the story? I don't remember exactly what the connection was.
Well, people like Benjamin Rush and another one I mentioned, Silas Weir Mitchell, who was a 19th century neurologist, were Philadelphia figures. And so they were part of his Freeman's consciousness as he was growing up in Philadelphia. Probably the psychiatrist who had, I think, perhaps unintentionally, had the biggest influence on Freeman's decision to continue with lobotomy was Adolf Meyer, who was a very well-known psychiatrist of the 1920s, 30s, 40s, and taught at Johns Hopkins University. And there was a report that Freeman and Watts was giving very early in the game, I think in 1936, at a medical conference in Baltimore. And they were getting a lot of heat from the other psychiatrists and physicians in attendance about, you know, do they know that lobotomy works? How do they know these patients have been helped? Maybe they've been helped not by the lobotomy, but simply by the shock of surgery. And Meyer, who is an elderly man by that point, stood up and really quieted the crowd and said, this is something that merits investigation, and I trust that Walter Freeman and James Watts will conduct their investigations prudently. That really shut everybody up, and a lot of the doctors in attendance felt that they couldn't challenge Dr. Meyer on that. So that was an instance in which he got a lot of help, unsolicited help from a physician. Another important figure in the book is John Fulton, who is not a psychiatrist but a physiologist. And Fulton ran at Yale University a chimp brain laboratory where various experiments were done on chimpanzees to find out about the functioning of the brain. And it was at a medical conference in London in 1935. Fulton and one of his colleagues, Carlisle Jacobson, reported on the experiences of these two chimps, Becky and Lucy, who had their frontal lobes removed. The experimenters had done that, and how that changed their behavior. Agas Moniz was in attendance, the Portuguese neurologist, at this. Freeman was as well. But Moniz heard the account and soon after began his leucotomy operations. I think one of the reasons why so many interesting figures from psychiatry and neurology play into the story is because a great deal of the story has to do with the conflict between psychiatrists who believed in the biological bases of mental illnesses and those who were believers in Freudian psychoanalysis and believed that there were behavioral origins to many diseases. And Freeman, of course, was on the biological side of the argument. And that is a big framework around within which the whole lobotomy story takes place.
Interesting. Now, I'm still wondering about those chimpanzees, though. What was the effect of removing their frontal lobes?
Well, it was different in each of the two chimps, and so there really weren't strong conclusions that could be drawn. In one of the chimps, Fulton and his colleagues did in the lab was they subjected the chimps to various problem-solving activities before and after the removal of the frontal lobe. So after the operations, there was one chimp who became much more easily frustrated and aggravated during the puzzle-solving exercises, and then there was another who became much calmer and subdued, was less frustrated. And I think that's the one that Moniz focused on when he decided to try leucotomy on his patients in Portugal, hoping that that the symptoms of illnesses that he was seeing in the patients, the violent behavior, outbursts, hallucinations, etc., would be blunted by the leucotomies.
Yes. So I gather there was a period during which Freeman was riding high, maybe because of the kind of politically correct endorsement of Adolf Meyer, and it created the sort of politically correct situation where people were afraid to speak up. But it sounds like there was a lot of enthusiasm. Even he was endorsed by Carl Menninger initially.
Yes, which is surprising, isn't it?
Yeah.
There are a few reasons for this early support. One is that Freeman was a master of manipulating the press, and he got a lot of very favorable press coverage early on, in which the writers of the articles made unjustified claims for what lobotomy could accomplish. But another had to do with the genuine problem that Freeman was trying to treat, which was the lack of effective treatments for mentally ill people. And there were a lot of people who were out there who were rooting for someone to come up with an effective treatment. Most of Freeman's support, I would say, came from neurosurgeons, even though they didn't like the idea of a non-surgeon like Freeman doing these operations. But they were predisposed to like surgery on the brain as a possible treatment for mental disorders. Mm-hmm. And he also had widespread support, I would say, among certain groups of neurologists and psychiatrists. The psychiatrists who most often opposed him early on were those who did it for ideological reasons, not for ethical reasons, those who had the Freudian psychoanalytic orientation. To them, the idea of operating on the brain to treat a disorder was foolish and wasteful and ridiculous. But as time went on, Freeman lost a lot of his popular support. Lobotomy really hit the mainstream peak in 1949 when Moniz, the Portuguese doctor, won a Nobel Prize for his development of psychiatric surgery. After that, in the few years after that, there were a lot of lobotomies done all over the country by hundreds, if not thousands, of doctors, to the tune of 40 or 50,000 operations being done in the United States. But when new drugs became available, like Thorazine, in the mid-50s, and it was found that those drugs worked as well, if not better, than lobotomy without some of the really potentially debilitating side effects of lobotomy, that's when Freeman began to lose a lot of his support, because he continued to believe that lobotomy was better than the pharmaceuticals.
In the beginning of the book, you said that there were two questions that you posed for yourself that you hoped to answer. And the first was, why was Freeman so attracted to this procedure?
Mm-hmm.
And I think you've spoken to that by emphasizing that there was this crying need for some kind of improvement in terms of psychiatric care. So certainly that was a big piece of the answer. Was there more to that answer that you discovered as well?
Well, the other aspect of the answer was something else that I mentioned earlier on, which had to do with his drive to be seen as an innovator.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think he saw lobotomy as his ticket, but not only to fame, but also to respect and accomplishment, just as his grandfather had been seen in those terms. So I think that's the other half of that answer.
Yeah. And then the second question that you posed for yourself was, why did Freeman keep performing lobotomies in the face of overwhelming criticism from his colleagues?
I think I found the answer to that as well, and it's a complicated answer. It has to do with Freeman's inner demons, I believe, that there came a time when Freeman, I don't think, could separate himself from the practice of lobotomy, no matter what other evidence was out there or what anyone else said. He by 1950 or so, he was the lobotomist, and I think that without that distinction, there wasn't much left to Walter Freeman professionally. And he had always had this quality, which is attached to that loner quality that I mentioned earlier, of being very resistant to criticism. People could come up to him on the street and call him a criminal and say that he had bankrupt ethics, tell him that right to his face, and he would not take it personally. It just rolled right off of him. And I think what it boils down to is that he was stubborn. He had found a solution, and he believed it was the best solution. And at the peril of his self-image, he couldn't separate himself from it. And so that's why, even after the arrival of effective medications, he continued to advocate for lobotomy, even performing lobotomies more and more on adolescent children, and running into very bitter conflicts with other psychiatrists. But he did have one natural group of allies who stayed with him for a long time, and those were the people who ran psychiatric hospitals, some of whom were MDs and some weren't. And they by and large liked lobotomy because it did get patients out of the hospital. I think it's important to mention that many people, by the standards of the time, did improve after their lobotomies. Lobotomy did not affect anybody's intelligence, didn't make anyone made very few people into the drooling vegetables that we often think of when we conjure up images of lobotomy. There were people who were able to return home from hospitals after their lobotomies, did get back into their families, did return to their jobs, even quite challenging jobs as musicians, as teachers. There was one lobotomy patient who went back to a job as the director of a psychiatric hospital. And so Freeman was wedded to it, and he associated with other people who were wedded to it. Those became fewer in number as time went on. But to his dying day, Walter Freeman believed that lobotomy was the answer, and he never wavered.
And isn't it the case, though, that in some ways he was right? I mean, that the frontal lobes are implicated in various kinds of anxiety and so on, and now that maybe some of the same effects are being accomplished with pharmaceuticals?
Yeah, that's a very interesting contemporary part of this story, that of course the biological view of treating psychiatric illnesses that Freeman was on this leading edge of is in command now, and no, I don't think anyone would want to credit him with that, but it is something that he helped get out there, and that he promoted you know, he promoted that biological view at a time when it wasn't a very popular view, when most psychiatrists took the other behavioral view. But there are, I don't think anyone should come away thinking that surgery is no longer used to treat psychiatric problems. There are still a small number of brain operations done not using leukotomes, not going through the eye orbit, but using gamma rays and other methods of very precisely producing lesions in various regions of the brain that are sometimes used to treat chronic depression and obsessive compulsive disorder. And then, of course, it's becoming more and more common to see people who have these implanted electrostimulation devices that stimulate the vagus nerve, which feeds the brain, or deep brain stimulation. So Freeman, you know, regardless of what you think of him, and I think of him as not a criminal anymore, but as a very flawed person who had good qualities and some very serious bad qualities. But regardless of what you think of him, he did introduce that kind of approach to the treatment of psychiatric illnesses. And I believe he deserves some credit for that.
Yeah. So he doesn't really emerge so much as a criminal or evil or a quack, but really as a brilliant, but as you point out, a brilliant but flawed individual who, in some ways, was ahead of his time, and who was unresponsive to feedback that he should have been listening to. Is that fair, or am I being
too
kind?
Yeah, it is fair. I think it, in my mind, it transformed my thinking from that black and white picture to a field of many shades of gray.
Yeah.
And I'm glad of that, because that kind of person is more interesting than the Mengele-type monster. His motivations were complex, and that's what kept me interested in spending all those years researching and writing and finishing the book, because I never grew tired of Walter Freeman. I dreamed about him. I would love to sit across from him at a dinner table. I would not want him as my neurologist or psychiatrist, but I would certainly have loved to have had the chance to meet him.
Yeah. And by the way, you did mention that you were able to interview a few lobotomized patients. What were those interviews like?
Well, it varied a lot. I think there's a kind of a process of natural selection involved, in the sense that anybody who had a lobotomy and is still with us today, I think, is by necessity one of the patients who did better than the others.
Mm-hmm.
That by and large, most lobotomy patients died a long time ago, and especially the ones who didn't turn out well, whose lives and health was not improved by their lobotomies, I think they probably didn't live long to begin with. And so I have talked with patients who are doing quite well now. There's a former Freeman patient named Howard Dully, who is now in his mid-50s, had a lobotomy in the early 60s when he was 12, and he's doing great. In fact, he's writing a book about his experiences now, and he narrated a very intriguing National Public Radio documentary that was broadcast a little over a year ago. And then I've interviewed a few other patients that are doing well, in varying degrees. I have also met a couple of others who I don't think anyone would say they're doing well. But it's hard to separate the operation from the illness.
Mm-hmm.
And to know whether the problems they have today are a result of having schizophrenia for decades or of having undergone a lobotomy.
Did any of the people that you spoke to have the feeling of having been misused?
Some, in the sense, especially those who had lobotomies as children or adolescents, they didn't consent to the operation. Often they didn't understand what was happening to them or know why they were getting it. That's certainly true in Howard Dully's case. And I also spoke with family members. And there is a division there, too. Some who believe that the lobotomy had helped the member of their family, and some who didn't. You know, one really eye-opening moment of my research came when I went to the Freeman Archive at George Washington University and found that there were boxes and boxes full of Christmas cards that Freeman had received from patients over the years. I sure didn't expect that. And that the cards were written sometimes very well. These were not people who sounded mentally damaged. And they often expressed not only gratitude to Freeman, but also a sense that he was part of their extended family and that they would like to see him at any chance they could get. Then there were also some letters from family members who felt much differently, and those I expected to find, those who thought that their daughter or wife, spouse, whatever, had not been helped by the lobotomy and sometimes were quite bitter about it.
Yeah. This makes me think of contemporary alternative treatments that are controversial. And, and they all seem to be able to gather a certain number of testimonials and have adherents that speak up for them and on the other hand, are roundly criticized by others. So this all sounds very contemporary in a certain way.
There is a contemporary aspect to it. And new medical treatments that are failures, and I think, ultimately you'd have to regard lobotomy as a failure, occur all the time. It's not an isolated incident. The path of lobotomy from early innovation to great popularity to a rather steep decline in popularity isn't unusual, I don't think, and has been repeated many times in medical history.
Okay, Jack, to kind of close things off here, what lessons should we take away from this book?
One important lesson that remains with me is how closely the course of a treatment is aligned to the personality of its advocate. That lobotomy, I'm convinced, could not have become as widespread in its use as it did without Walter Freeman as its advocate. And we wouldn't have such a negative image of it today that we have without Walter Freeman.
Right.
Also, Freeman, because, as I said, of many of his personal problems, really anchored himself to lobotomy. And nobody who knew him well, professionally or personally, picked up on that at the time. So I think it's very important for medical investigators to keep an eye on their colleagues, in a sense, to watch what's going on in their personal lives, to make sure that someone isn't advocating something for the wrong reasons, reasons that may seem right to them, but are actually tied into personal problems.
Yes.
So I think that's important. And another is simply that context is important, too, that we can't understand. It's very hard to understand today how anyone could expect a lobotomy to help someone. But given the climate in which Freeman was working and in which his patients were suffering, then it does become understandable. It may be that 50 years from now, people will wonder, why would anyone undergo chemotherapy, for instance, to treat cancer? And it's because it's a good option among the treatments that we have available to us now. But that may not be so clear 50 years from now. Time makes a difference.
Yes. Well, Jack L. High, thanks so much for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you for having me, David. It's been a lot of fun and a great pleasure.
Well, I certainly hope you enjoyed this conversation with Jack L. High. You know, the feedback that I get from listeners, both in emails and on our survey about the show, I often hear how much listeners appreciate the diversity of topics that we cover here. I have to say, though, that I never expected that I would go so far afield as to do a podcast on lobotomies. But you never know where this is going to take us to. You know, speaking of things having to do with the brain, you might recall that in show number 81, just a few shows back, it was about anxiety disorders with Dr. Wayne Eastlack. And you might recall that I mentioned that he would be offering an all-day workshop. Well, I went to that all-day workshop, and I have to say it was really wonderful. He has a great sense of humor and is a wonderful presenter. So I highly recommend him if you're looking to attend a workshop and he happens to do anything that's in your area. He does it through an organization called Cross Country Education that you'll find at crosscountryeducation.com. And I'm not getting paid to give that a plug, but I really thought he did a great job. And he spent a lot of time going over the brain and brain processes in his presentation. And, you know, a long time ago, I was in graduate school, and I remember taking a course in physiological psychology, and I had to memorize as part of that course all these brain anatomical structures like the amygdala and the amygdala, the hypothalamus, the frontal lobes, the cerebellum, the limbic system, you know, all these different structures. But there really wasn't that much that was known about what they did. It was more just like memorizing these places in the brain. Well, boy, oh boy, have things ever evolved over the years. I was blown away by how detailed Dr. Eastlack's understanding was of how these various anxiety disorders have locations in specific areas of the brain, the neurotransmitters that are involved both in producing the anxiety and producing well-being, the way that a variety of medications interact at various receptor sites and all. I was able to spell this all out with amazing detail that would not have been possible not very long ago. So there have been tremendous advances in terms of our understanding of the brain. It really brought that home to me in a very big way. I also, I had the opportunity to have lunch with him, and over lunch, he said, hey, you know, somebody that you should talk to is Dr. Daniel Amen. Well, if you recall, if you've been with the show for a while, he was my guest way back in episode number 55 on psychopathology and the mind. And Wayne Eastlack has attended a number of Dr. Amen's workshops and came away very impressed with his work and the specificity of relating various disorders to regions of the brain. So that was interesting for me to hear, both in terms of, hey, that I was ahead of the game in terms of having already interviewed somebody that he thought would be a great interview. And also, you might recall, I was a little bit reserved in my evaluation of Dr. Amen's work. I wasn't sure how much it was up on the up and up. But the fact that Dr. Eastlack is impressed by his work strengthens my willingness to believe everything that was presented in the podcast and in Dr. Amen's book. So I thought I should give you that update. You know, normally after the interview, I like to comment on my own experience with the content of what the person I interviewed was speaking about. Well, in this case, I mean, what experience do I have with lobotomies or with lobotomized patients? But I was talking some time back to my friend Jerry Trumbull, who you will recall from episodes number 3 and number 4, if you've been with us that long. And he had mentioned actually coming in contact with a woman who had had a lobotomy. So I thought that might be interesting right here. So I'm going to play a little bit of a phone conversation, a Skype conversation that I had with Jerry, in which he recollects that. Hey, Jerry, I remember that we had a conversation earlier. You know, I've just done a podcast interview with a guy who has written a book about it's called The Lobotomist, and it's about this Dr. Freeman, who I guess pretty much was the lobotomist, though a lot of other surgeons picked it up, but he was the guy who really championed it in this country and who did most of them. And I remembered having a conversation with you that you actually met somebody once who had a lobotomy. And
yeah, that's true.
I have never knowingly interacted with somebody who's had a lobotomy. People might not be terribly forthcoming about that.
Yeah, I was when I was 17, I was selected by a religious group to travel around, basically proselytizing to the youth of the Lutheran Church.
Okay, so you were kind of a missionary at 17, huh?
Yeah, the format was that we would go to a town, and we would stay with either the minister or a member of the congregation for 3 days while we had our youth sessions. And then we would move on to another town. And I've forgotten exactly where this town was, but I think it was in Nebraska. And we went to the minister's home to stay. And as soon as we got there, were three of us, and as soon as we got there, he sat us down and explained that his wife had had a lobotomy some years before to try to cure her kleptomania.
Interesting.
And that she had been stealing toothpaste and men's pants. And that when they found out, they found that she had drawers filled with toothpaste and a huge collection of men's pants.
Oh, if I were a Freudian, which I partly am, one could have a field day with that.
Yeah, I'm not sure how to make that connection, but I'll leave that to you. But so we kind of looked at each other and said, oh, okay, whatever. Because we did, in the course of that summer, run into a number of strange situations. But then we were introduced to the wife, and she seemed quite normal. She didn't seem to have any spontaneous behavior. She would never volunteer a statement, but if you asked her something, she was quite verbal and didn't seem to have any problems. So we carried on our endeavors for the 3 days, and then we left and went to the next town, whereupon shortly thereafter, my companion said, oh, my God, I'm missing a pair of brown pants. Of course, we laughed, and he did make a phone call back to the previous minister's house, and he said, oh, I'm sorry, I'll find them and send them to you, so... A few days later, a package arrived, and it was a pair of pants, but it was not my friend's pants. It was somebody else's pants. So I think he just left it at that. But later, when I learned about lobotomies and what had been imposed on a whole bunch of people, I don't know, the one that I remember the best was from the movie... Fanny Farmer, who was a movie star in the 30s, I recall, and because of her rebellious behavior, she was given a lobotomy, and a movie was made about her whole life called Fanny Farmer.
Yeah.
And that gave me some insight into it, and it just seemed like a very strange period in history where... a brutal operation was performed on people with little or no evidence.
Yeah, well, you want to at least listen to the podcast, and if you're interested in the book, let me know, and I'll send it to you.
For sure, I'll be anxious to do that. Yeah,
yeah. I seem to recall, and I can't tell if I'm making this up or not, but I seem to recall that when I was in graduate school at the University of Michigan, one of my supervisors somehow it came up in the discussion. And somebody and the supervisor saying, oh, yes, you know, there are people around who've had lobotomies. And I know of a case of somebody who runs quite a large corporation and is, you know, totally effective. And indeed, the guy that I interviewed said that he's aware of such cases as well.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah. So it's interesting. It was a mixed bag, so to speak. Thanks for being willing to come on and share this recollection.
My pleasure. Anytime.
Okay. You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave.
And shrink wrap radio is playing on again. Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head.
Don't forget about my other podcast interview series, which you will find at wisecounsel.mentalhelp.net. Currently, the latest interview there is still with Dr. Steve Hayes, who's developed an approach to psychotherapy called Acceptance Commitment Therapy, or ACT, and it's based on 30 years of research. And I have to say, he was one of the most dynamic and interesting guests I've had. Maybe I need to bring him on Shrink Wrap Radio. But at any rate, once again, you can hear him at wisecounsel.mentalhelp.net. You'll notice there's a Frapper icon in the green bar on the left of the pages at shrinkwrapradio.com. And if you haven't put yourself on our Frapper map yet, that's where you do it. Now, speaking of which, we have two new additions to our Frapper map. And I want to give a big thank you and a welcome to Gabby in Olympia, Washington, and Jonathan in New Orleans, Louisiana, or New Orleans, Louisiana. And a big thank you to our sponsors, as usual, Podshow and GoDaddy. One of the places you'll find this show is at shrinkwrapradio.podshow.com, and you can subscribe to it there as well as on our regular site. And you'll find great GoDaddy discounts for all your domain name and web hosting needs on our website at shrinkwrapradio.com. In fact, Jerry Trumbull, who you just heard, told me that he just saved himself some money on GoDaddy purchasing denverdirect.tv. Not only did he save himself some money, but he also helped to support Shrink Wrap Radio. Way to go, Jerry. Okay, you kissed the Blarney Stone. I was too scared. Mm. We're high up. What was it like for you?
To be quite honest, now, I thought, like, I've heard of the Blarney Stone down in my county, like, and I often heard them saying, like, kiss the Blarney Stone. I thought the Blarney Stone was actually on ground level.
Right.
Until I came to this old castle down in Blarney, I had to climb. I'd done many steps up to this Blarney Stone, and then I had to lean back and put my head right way back. And it was the most nervousest thing I ever did in my life. I climbed Croke Patrick, I've done everything, but that was the most very experience.
Yeah, they had to I've hold your done. Legs, right?
I had to hold my legs.
So you didn't fall through.
Didn't fall through.
Yeah. Right. Thanks. No. Thank you. That's got to be one of my favorite sound snippets ever. If there are leprechauns, that's what I would imagine them to sound like. I must get back to Ireland. I discovered I only got out 3 Shrink Wrap Radio episodes in March. I'd hoped to do at least 4 a month. It was a combination of things that set me behind. I was having some computer problems, which hopefully are now resolved. I also spent a lot of time in March getting the new website squared away. This month is looking pretty busy as well. You may know that I also have an online market research business. Well, I have 3 projects that have come in all at the same time and all need to be executed this week and next, and maybe the one following. Consulting work is known to be feast or famine, and right now I guess I'm in the feast phase, so I should be grateful for that. I don't know if you've noticed, but I've stopped giving the date at the front end of the show. My reason for no longer doing so is my belief that most of these episodes are not time-sensitive. I think many of these interviews will still be relevant and interesting years down the road. At least I hope so. I was afraid that giving the date might lead people to think that the older material might not be worthwhile. Let me know if you have any reactions one way or the other about this change. Well, let's take a dip into the mailbag. First, we hear from Christine, who writes, "Somehow by mistake, I logged onto your website and heard an amazing podcast interview with Jeremy Donovan Unfortunately, there seems to be no indication of the date of the interview, but I presume it must have been late last year or maybe this year. Yeah, it was quite recently, actually, just a show or two ago. She goes on to write, I live in Sydney, Australia, and really know nothing about Jeremy. I don't think he's very well known here. I agree his story so far to age 26 years is worth a movie being made. What an amazing young man. It's also amazing that I had to hear about Jeremy via an interview in the U.S. and not here in Australia. I have a feeling we are not very appreciative of our artists over here, particularly Indigenous ones. Thank you for a most inspiring piece of audio, Christine, Sydney, Australia. Well, Christine, thanks so much for taking the time to write. And yours is the only feedback I've gotten so far on the show with Jeremy. And I also think that he's very special. Would love to hear from others about that. And you say you accidentally ended up on the website. Well, I hope you accidentally keep coming back. I wonder what you were really looking for that brought you to the website by accident. And if you've if you do continue to listen to the show, you'll know that we sometimes question whether or not there are any accidents. Okay, the next one comes from Bob, who writes, Dear Dr. Dave, I'm continuing to enjoy your show and recommend it to others. Oh, good. I'm glad you're recommending it. I'm the Feldenkrais guy from Philadelphia who contacted you some time ago. And by the way, if you don't know, Feldenkrais is an approach to body work, sort of a psychological body therapy thing. And he goes on to say, my Feldenkrais work probably has a much more autonomic emphasis than other Feldenkraisers. As I mentioned in a previous email, I've done a lot of biofeedback and neurofeedback as a participant, not as a practitioner. Probably more significantly, I studied extensively with Charlotte Selver, Charles Brooks, and more extensively with one of Charlotte's teachers, Carola Speeds. I've been hearing a lot and reading a lot about Stephen, and I'm not sure I'm going to say this name correctly, Porges, and his polyvagal theory. In reading about it, I get the sense that I've been applying similar approaches in my work. Unfortunately, it's often very technical, and I haven't yet gotten a clear sense of what they are after and how it's been applied. If you can get Dr. Porges or someone who has incorporated this theory or who can explain it in a straightforward way, it would be much appreciated. I hope you are well. I love your show. Best wishes, Bob. Bob, thanks for that suggestion. I haven't heard of that approach, and I'll put it on my giant to-do list. The next one comes from Susan, who writes, Dave, last year I wrote suggesting shrink wrap radio topics including archetypes and disability, and the Fool archetype interview contained both. I really enjoyed both the Fool insights and her tales of poor vision mishaps. Her guide dog licking a bald head in a concert audio in a concert audience really makes me chuckle. Thanks, Dave. Well, Susan, thanks so much for writing. And like the little tailor in the fairy tale, I'm so happy that I got two in one blow for you. And it was great having you revivify for me that image of the dog licking the bald man's head. That was very funny. And next we hear from longtime listener Lloyd, who speaks to my need for periodic reassurance. He says, Hi, I've been writing to your show for a long time, but just wanted to let you know once again how good your show is. Your interview style is great. I think it's so good because you're trying to get a mental model in your own head and ask questions when pieces do not fit. This is exactly what the listener is trying to do also. So your show is excellent for someone who wants to learn. I have also started listening to Wise Counsel, which is equally good. I've been introduced to hundreds of new concepts through your shows and am truly grateful. So yes, you are performing a great service to the world, which you've stated to be your primary goal. Congratulations on your success. Mission Control extends the greatest thanks and appreciation for your work. Well, thanks, Lloyd, and I really appreciate that. You know, I've just found out that I'm going to be doing a presentation at the annual podcaster event, which is called the Podcast and New Media Expo. And that's coming up in September, end of September, down in Southern California. And actually, I'm planning to present on the interview as the as an ideal format for educators. That is for educators who want to do podcasting, because it's turned out to be such a wonderful format for me. And so I want to share that with other people. And who knows, Lloyd, I might find a reason to quote your email in that presentation. And I later got another email from Lloyd responding to, and again, this goes back to the interview about the fool, in which I noted that my copy of the book Jung and Tarot by Sally Nichols, that I discovered there were missing pages. So Lloyd wrote and says, oh yes, Mission Control advises that the pages in your Sally Nichols Jung and Tarot book were deliberately removed. We had a fly jam itself in the printing press at the precise time that would cause those pages to be blank, much like the movie Brazil. Our reason is long and complex, but suffice it to say, reading those pages would have grave implications for your future. Also, like in the movie Brazil. If you have any questions, please watch the movie Brazil. Best regards, Mission Control. You know, I saw Brazil, the movie, years ago, and I guess I thought it was going to be about Brazil. So I kept waiting for the jungle scenes and so on. It's a, as I recall, it's a very droll British humor send-up, kind of a science fiction, low-budget send-up. And maybe I didn't get it, I suspect. I think I have to see it again. So I just recently joined Netflix, so I'll have to put that on my Netflix list. And let's see, next we hear from... you know, and I wish I knew how to pronounce your name, but I don't think I've heard you say it. It looks like Quiquian, maybe it's Quijian, who is originally from China, and we've had some correspondence and on Skype and in email, and I received the most recent email from him. And I should mention he's from China, and he was, I think, in Australia, and now in the U.S., to study Buddhism. So it's ironic that a person in China needs to leave the country in order to study Buddhism. But he writes, hello, David, how are you? Glad to see your new website. It looks pretty cool. Just wondering whether you want to find your way back to teaching as an adjunct professor, since I find you not only a good radio host, but also a good teacher. University of the West is recruiting an adjunct professor. If you're interested, please look at it. And then he gives me the web address there about the job opening. Well, having been a fool professor, I'm hardly ready to step back and be an adjunct professor. Hey, thanks so much, though, for thinking of me in that regard. I did go to their website. I see it's a very interesting institution that blends Buddhism and Western psychology, Eastern thought, and a lot else. And looks like it would be good. But, you know, I've got a lot on my plate right now, and I taught for so many years that I'm really not looking to go back into it, except in as much as I'm able to do so in this podcast. So there are some more emails from way back that I haven't gotten to yet, but I think I better wrap it up for now. So remember, you can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave voicemails on Skype, where our name is ShrinkPod. And you are encouraged, really strongly encouraged, to leave messages on my Chingo. There's a logo on the Shrink Wrap Radio website. All you need is a microphone hooked into your computer, and you can leave a voice message. And in the U.S., you can leave voicemail on our phone. And I've been giving out the wrong phone number for I don't know how long. The right one is 206-337-0622. It was even wrong on the website, and I just corrected it. On the last show, even, I gave out the wrong phone number, and I've been begging people to leave messages. And so if you left a recording and I haven't played it, it's because I didn't get it. So please go back to this new number and do it again. And if you didn't leave one, use this new number and leave a message. Listener Susie wrote to ask what I had planned to celebrate the 100th episode of Shrink Wrap Radio. And as I mentioned before, I haven't thought about it too much, but I realize it's coming up fast. I've already got the interview for number 85 in the can, so to speak. So let me know if you've got any good ideas for celebrating our 100th birthday. And I would really like to get a bunch of voice birthday greetings for Shrink Wrap Radio that I could play on that episode. Okay, so thanks again to Jack L. High for the interview. Now, in past shows, we've spoken a lot about the hero's journey. Well, in response to a listener's request, our next show will feature therapist and author Maureen Murdoch about her book, The Journey of the Heroine. That's it for now. This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.